Our sermon passage today comes from the book of Matthew. Matthew can be found at the beginning of the New Testament. Please turn there with me and follow along as I read Matthew chapter 15, verses 21 through 39. And Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon." But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and begged him, saying, "Send her away, for she is crying out after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered, "It is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." She said, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Then Jesus answered her, "O woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire." And her daughter was healed instantly. Jesus went on from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee. And he went up on the mountain and sat down there. And great crowds came to him, bringing with them the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others. And they put them at his feet, and he healed them, so that the crowd wondered when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled healthy, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. Then Jesus called his disciples to him and said, "I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat, and I am unwilling to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way." And the disciples said to him, "Where are we to get enough bread in such a desolate place to feed so great a crowd?" And Jesus said to them, "How many loaves do you have?" They said, "Seven, and a few small fish." And directing the crowd to sit down on the ground, he took the 7 loaves and the fish, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. And they all ate and were satisfied, and they took up 7 baskets full of the broken pieces left over. Those who ate were 4,000 men, besides women and children. And after sending away the crowds, he got into the boat and went to the region of Magadan. This is the word of the Lord.
Thank you, Ellie. Well, this morning we continue our sermon series in the book of Matthew. And as we do, we're going to dive into this passage that Ellie just read here in chapter 15, verses 21 through 39. And we've mentioned this as elders a couple different times over the last couple weeks or few weeks. But last weekend, we had our annual elder retreat. And I know we call it a retreat and kind of a laughing joke. It's not a retreat. It's more like a 2-day long elder meeting in which we kind of plan for next year, 2026, and just spend some time just assessing kind of where we are in the life of our church. And so we began this elder retreat giving each elder a stack of sticky notes. And the assignment for each of us as elders was to think about our church in these 4 different categories. And so one would be our strengths, so areas that we feel like we're doing well in as a church that we want to continue to build on as a church. Another category then would be weaknesses, areas that we want to improve in and correct and grow in together as a church. Another category was opportunities. So just unique opportunities that we feel like the Lord is laying before us as a church that we can maximize and leverage for the good of our body and for the advancement of the gospel and all those things. And last category then was threats. So potential threats from the inside or outside of our church that could negatively affect us as a church and those within our body. So had these stack of sticky notes, and the assignment was just to take a sticky note and to write down a strength, or take a sticky note and write down a weakness. And so we just began to write down different strengths, different weaknesses, and we placed them on a wall. And so all the strengths went over here, the weaknesses went over here, the opportunities went over there, and the threats went over there. And so had this big wall of just sticky notes. And it was an interesting exercise, to say the least. Insightful in a lot of different ways. I remember one area in the life of our church that will remain nameless that I put as a strength and Nate Gutwein put as a weakness. And so we argued about that for a couple days and never resolved it. And so anyway, there was another area that every elder, I believe, put as a weakness in our church. And some elders put as an opportunity in our church. And so think about that. And you don't need to answer this out loud, please. But an area in our church, think about that. Can you name an area in our church, not out loud, that is a weakness on one hand and an opportunity on the other hand? Well, that particular area that we as elders think all of us identified as a weakness and some elders identified as an opportunity within this particular local church is none other than global missions. So think about that real quick. If you were here at the beginning of the year in January, we had like around 30-ish people or so at an informational meeting before the worship gathering. And these 30 people were interested on some level of learning more about our sending process as a church for sending missionaries overseas and our theology of missions for missionaries and who we will partner with and all of that. There's 30 people who had some level of interest of being sent, of going overseas. And so you think about that, like since then, that was January, and like since then, like I've had a lot of other conversations with people who weren't in that meeting, and since then that number's just increased. And so we see that and think about that, like, man, what an opportunity. What a goldmine in so many different ways that God has uniquely given us in this particular local church to send missionaries and be involved in the Great Commission to reach nations and to plant churches among unreached people groups and those who have little to no access to the gospel, and that we as a little church in Overland Park, Kansas can play a part in that. Like what an opportunity. At the same time, if we were honest, say missions is also a weakness in our church. And one of the reasons it's a weakness in our church is because it's an area that I don't think like we as elders have always done a very good job of leading out in. I don't think we as elders have always done a very good job of shepherding the church and shepherding those who aspire to be sent and aspire to be missionaries. In many ways, even now, there's confusion about who will send as a missionary, who will partner with as missionaries, what our sending process is. Even now, there's a lack of clarity when it comes to just what our theology of missions is, what our understanding, what the task of a missionary is, what kind of churches that we want to send people to plant overseas, and a whole host of other questions. And so then, one of our major priorities when it comes to 2026, this upcoming year, is to do a better job just as elders when it comes to defining all of these things that I just mentioned and answering all of these questions in a more precise, detailed sort of way that it serves those who aspire to be sent as missionaries. And one of the reasons, though, that we want to do that is because of the opportunity that God has given to us as a church. And we don't want to squander that opportunity. We don't want to waste that opportunity. Instead, we want to faithfully lead our church to be a missionary sending base that identifies and assesses and trains and sends and supports missionaries from our church and to be able to send them among all the nations in the world. All of that then begs this question. Why? Why? Like, why should we as a church care about global missions? Like, why should we care about the nations? Why should we prioritize? Why should we sacrifice? Why should we be concerned about unreached, unengaged people groups and places around the world that have little to no access to the gospel? Like, why should we care about and be concerned about planting churches in places where there's no churches? And not only that, but let's even get even more specific and even more personal here. Like, why should those who aren't missionaries, why should those here this morning who have no plans of buying a plane ticket, selling all your stuff, and moving overseas to be a missionary? Like, why should stay-at-home moms, electricians, engineers, teachers, and just fill in the blank, care about and be concerned about global missions and all these things that I just mentioned? Why? Well, that's what we're going to see within our passage here this morning. It's what we're going to see in these three different stories, these three different accounts, these three different miracles. What these three different accounts and miracles are going to do is that they're going to explain to us the why of missions. They're going to explain to us why every single Christian, why every single follower of Jesus is to be a global Christian. Now, that doesn't mean that every Christian is to be a missionary, but it does mean that every Christian is to be concerned about and care about global missions. It does mean that every single Christian and follower of Jesus is to be concerned about and care about and actively and sacrificially involved in seeking to play a part in reaching the nations with the gospel for the glory of Jesus. And that's what these three miracle stories that we're going to see here in our passage this morning are here to teach us and show us. And as we see all this, as these stories teach us the why of missions, I pray that they would fuel inside of us, of all of us, like no matter who you are, a desire and an intentionality to be more proactively and sacrificially engaged in helping the nations come to worship King Jesus. And so then that's where we're headed in our time together this morning. So let's dive in to these three astonishing miracles. And the first miracle we're going to see is this, is that Jesus is going to heal a Canaanite woman's daughter. So what we see in verse 21, look there with me at verse 21. Matthew writes this. He says in verse 21, "And Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon." So then you read that, and at first glance, it might not seem like it, but that verse is huge in the book of Matthew. And the reason it's huge in the book of Matthew is because there's a huge shift that is occurring in Jesus' ministry in verse 21 here. And this shift occurs in this change of geography. If you notice here in verse 21, Matthew says that Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And so then it's really important to understand where there is and to understand where Tyre and Sidon are. And so the word there here in verse 21 is a reference to Galilee. And the reason that's significant is because Galilee is Jewish territory. It's where Jesus has been doing 98% of his ministry, starting all the way back, if you remember, in Matthew chapter 4. That most of his teachings, most of his miracles, most of his healings, most of his parables, all of those things were happening in the Jewish territory of Galilee. But if you remember, as we've seen over the last few chapters, while Jesus is doing all his ministry in Jewish territory of Galilee, there's been this growing intensity and growing opposition against Jesus. This growing opposition against Jesus, particularly by the Jewish religious leaders and the Jewish political leaders in Galilee. And so they've heard Jesus' teachings. They've witnessed his miracles. They've seen it with their own eyes. But instead of recognizing that all of these teachings and all of these miracles point to the fact that he's the promised Messiah that God had promised to come from the Old Testament, they don't realize that. That they're clueless. And instead, if you remember all the way back in chapter 12, they attribute, the Jewish religious leaders, the Pharisees, attribute all the miracles that Jesus is doing. They don't see those miracles and say, oh, this is the one who was promised from the Old Testament. They see these miracles and say, he's doing all those by the power of the prince of demons. And because of that, they're offended by him. And if you remember, they want to destroy him. They want to kill him. And that opposition has been intensifying and growing until we get to verse 21 here in chapter 15. And this major shift. And Jesus goes from there, the Jewish territory, and he withdraws to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And you're like, what? Okay, where is that? Tyre and Sidon are in Gentile territory. If you know your Old Testament, they're evil, wicked, unclean, pagan, Gentile cities that the Pharisees, the religious leaders, Jewish religious leaders, would avoid traveling into because they were unclean territory and they thought they would be defiled if they went there. But in verse 22 then, look who the first person is that Jesus encounters as he enters into this unclean, pagan, evil, wicked, Gentile territory. Look at verse 22. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out. And so then what do we know about the Canaanites? Again, go back to the Old Testament. The Canaanites were the arch enemies of Israel. They occupied the land of Canaan when Israel was sent to go into the promised land that God had promised them. And God commanded them to drive them out and not mix with them because of how evil and wicked the people were there. And for years then, if you remember, the Canaanites were a threat to Israel and attacking over and over again the people of Israel in the land. And so that's who this woman is. And look what this woman does then when she approaches Jesus at the end of verse 22 there. She cries out, and just imagine the intensity of her cry here. She cries out, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon." And so Matthew's readers, if they were reading this, their jaws would have dropped at this point. Like, think about it. This Gentile Canaanite woman, who is a descendant of one of Israel's ancient enemies, has more understanding of who Jesus is than the Jewish religious leaders of Jesus' day, namely the Pharisees. Like, she knows, she confesses that Jesus is none other than the Son of David. Like, she knows that he's the one that God promised that would come as the Messiah, King from the line of David, who would reign as king forever and usher in a kingdom that would have no end, a kingdom of peace and justice and righteousness. While the Bible scholars, theology nerds of that day, the Jewish religious leaders, the Pharisees, the scholars of the Old Testament were completely clueless of who Jesus was. They had no understanding that he was the Son of David. Instead, they thought that he was doing all of these things by the prince of the power of demons. And so look at Jesus' response then in verse 23 to this Canaanite woman. It says, "But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and begged him, saying, 'Send her away, for she is crying out after us.' And he answered, 'I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.'" So you read that, and at first glance, you're thinking, man, Jesus, that's pretty cold. You're being kind of rude here, Jesus. Part of that might be true, but that's not the full story. That's not necessarily the case here. Instead, as the Messiah that was promised to come from the line of David, that God had promised, Jesus is carrying out his mission here. And that mission had an order and it had a priority. And the order and the priority was Israel first. That if you remember, just like Jesus sent his disciples all the way back in Matthew chapter 10 to only go to the lost sheep of Israel, not to the Samaritans and to the Gentiles. Well, in chapter 15, Jesus is doing the exact same thing here. But if you look here, Jesus' words here, they didn't deter this Canaanite woman. Look at how she responds in verse 25. It says, but she came and knelt before him saying, Lord, help me. In other words, she won't take no for an answer. She's persistent. Then look what Jesus tells her in verse 26. And Jesus answered, it is not right to take the children's bread and to throw it to the dogs. In other words, do you see what he's saying here? He's saying it's not right to take the ministry, the healings that are meant for Israel, the children, and to give it to the Gentiles, the dogs. It's what Jews would have called Gentiles back in the day. They would have called them dogs. But the word dog here isn't a reference to a wild, savage sort of dog. And so the word dog here would have been referenced like a puppy dog. A puppy dog, like a house dog that would lie under the table and eat the crumbs. And so look at verse 27, how this woman, this Canaanite woman, responds. She said, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. In other words, she's saying, Jesus, just keep on feeding the children. Keep on feeding Israel. But while you're doing that, can you let like a crumb or two just fall on us Gentiles? Can we just eat a crumb or two? In other words, keep on healing Israel. But can you let a few of those healing crumbs fall on us Gentiles too? Can you heal just a few of us Gentiles while you're busy healing all these people from Israel? And look how Jesus responds in verse 28. Then Jesus answered her, oh, woman, great is your faith. He commends her faith. He's astonished by her faith. Then he says this, let it be done for you as you desire. And her daughter was healed instantly. So do you see what we have here in this healing? We have a crumb, a healing crumb, falling off the table, falling from the table to the dogs, so the dogs can eat them, so the Gentiles can eat them, so this Canaanite woman's daughter can be healed. So keep that all in mind. That's the first miracle Jesus does here. Second miracle he does here is in verses 29 through 31. And in this miracle, Jesus is going to heal a whole bunch of Gentiles who are physically disabled. Okay, so what we see next in verse 29. Look there at verse 29. Matthew writes, Jesus went on from there, meaning Tyre and Sidon Gentile territory. He went on from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee. And he went up on the mountain and sat down there. And great crowds came to him, bringing with them the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others. And they put them at his feet, and he healed them. So that the crowd wondered, and they saw the mute speaking, the crippled healthy, the lame walking, and the blind seeing. And they glorified the God of Israel. And so then if you notice here in these three verses, Matthew doesn't specifically tell us the location of where Jesus is here. He doesn't tell us. He just uses the word there again. But there's two indicators within these verses that indicate that once again, Jesus is in Gentile territory, not Jewish territory. And one of the reasons we know that is because in the parallel account in Mark's gospel, in Mark chapter 7, verse 31, Mark tells us that Jesus is in the area of the Decapolis. And the area of the Decapolis would have been Gentile territory. And not only that, but secondly, if you look at the very end of this passage, in verse 31, we see how the people, when they see Jesus heal all these people and they see all the miracles that Jesus performs, we see how they respond. And at the end of verse 31, it says that they respond by glorifying the God of Israel, which implies there then that they weren't glorifying and worshiping the God of Israel Instead, they were Gentiles who were glorifying and worshiping other false gods. And so you put all that together, and so Jesus is once again in Gentile territory, just a different Gentile territory than Tyre and Sidon. And then verse 30 then says that great crowds then brought to him all these different types of people, the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and a whole bunch of others. And one after another, they're just rapidly just laying them out at Jesus' feet. Just one after another is the verb tense there. And then verse 30 says that Jesus healed them, like healed all of them. And so we don't know how many he healed. We don't know. We're not told exactly how he healed them. All we know, and just picture this, it's easy to take all this for granted, is that all of those who were mute started speaking. All those who were crippled were just healthy. All those who were lame and couldn't walk, boom, are walking. All those who were blind and couldn't see, instantly could see. And all of these things that are mentioned here, the lame, the crippled, the blind, the mute, all of these things are also mentioned in Isaiah chapter 35 of what the Messiah is going to do and who he's going to heal when he comes on the scene. And that's exactly what Jesus does. And when the Gentile crowd sees this in the end of verse 31, it says that they wondered, meaning they were astonished. They were amazed. And again, they glorified the God of Israel. Again, unclean, pagan, Gentile idolaters, turning from worshiping false gods and turning to worship the one true God of Israel. And so, catch it once again. What do we have here? Crumbs. Healing crumbs falling from the table to the dogs, to the Gentiles, so the Gentiles can eat them and be healed. And as a result of that, they worship the one true God of Israel. Remember that. Third astonishing miracle we see then is Jesus' feeding of the 4,000. His feeding of the 4,000. Look at verse 32 with me. Matthew writes, "Then Jesus called his disciples to him and said, 'I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And I'm unwilling to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way.' And the disciples said to him, 'Where are we to get enough bread in such a desolate place to feed so great a crowd?' And Jesus said to them, 'How many loaves do you have?' And they said, 7 and a few small fish. And directing the crowd to sit down on the ground, he took the 7 loaves and the fish. And having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to the disciples. And the disciples gave them to the crowds. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 7 baskets full of the broken pieces left over. Those who ate were 4,000 men besides women and children. And after sending away the crowds, he got into the boat and went to the region of Magadan." So you read this, right? You hear this again. And you're like, John, weren't you up here like a couple weeks ago basically preaching the same passage? Haven't we seen this already? Like, and I'm like, yeah, you kind of, sort of have. Remember a couple weeks ago back in Matthew chapter 14, we saw Jesus feed not the 4,000, but the 5,000, along with women and children. One chapter later, chapter 15, now we see another miraculous feeding account, not of 5,000, but of 4,000. So you read that, and that should like cause you to scratch your head. And the question it should cause you to ask is why? Like, why is he repeating basically the same story? Like, why is this here? Because this can't just be a coincidence that he just put this in. Like, why is this here? Why does he feed 5,000 just a few verses earlier, and then a few verses later he's feeding 4,000 once again? Didn't we learn the story and the point already back then? Why? Why are these two stories so closely connected together? Well, here's why. When Jesus fed the 5,000 in Matthew 14, those were 5,000 Jews. When Jesus feeds the 4,000 here in Matthew 15, those are 4,000 Gentiles. And the reason that we know that is because, once again, where this is occurring, it's occurring in the same exact location that the healings occurred that we just saw in verses 29 through 31 in the area of the Decapolis and in Gentile territory. And not only that, but if you look at the word baskets there in verse 37, that specific word for baskets in Matthew chapter 15, verse 37, is the word for baskets that Gentiles would have used. The word baskets here in Matthew 14 is for the feeding of the 5,000 is a different word for baskets than the word for baskets in Matthew 15 in the feeding of the 4,000. That Greek word is different. And the reason it's different is because the feeding of the 5,000, the 5,000 Jews, is referenced to baskets that of Jewish baskets that Jews used, and the baskets that are used in the feeding of the 4,000 among the Gentiles are the baskets that Gentiles used. That in Matthew 15, the baskets that Gentiles used, that word, just wrap your mind around this, and this blows up every children's story Bible you've ever read in your life. The word baskets here in Matthew 15 for Gentiles can also be translated as the word hamper. It's so big that a full adult grown man could fit in that basket. One commentator said 50 loaves of bread could have fit in that one of those baskets. We're talking about a big stinking honking basket here. Right? Yeah. Not only that, but did you notice in both of these feeding accounts, how many baskets were filled with leftovers? Did you notice that? That in the feeding of the 5,000, there were 12 baskets filled with leftovers. 12? Why 12? Well, in all likelihood, the number 12, so the number of the 12 tribes of Israel, is symbolic of God's provision for Israel, and that's which is whom Jesus was feeding in the feeding of the 5,000 with 12 baskets that were left over. Whereas in the feeding of the 4,000 of the Gentiles, you know how many baskets they had left over? Not 12. They had 7 baskets that were left over. Well, why 7? We'll go back to our sermon series in the book of Revelation. The number 7 in Scripture oftentimes signifies as completion, fullness, completeness. Something that's whole, all of something. So the 7 baskets here that are filled with leftovers probably symbolize Jesus' feeding of the whole world, of all the nations, of all the peoples, Jew and Gentile. And that's the point. That whereas Moses, if you remember, fed Israel in the wilderness in Exodus chapter 16, so Jesus now, the new and greater Moses, feeds both Jew and Gentile here in Matthew 14 and Matthew 15. It's in this way then that the feeding of the 4,000 Gentiles here, it's another picture. We have more crumbs falling from the table for the Gentile dogs to eat and to enjoy. That Jesus just doesn't feed Jews. He also feeds Gentiles. And both of these feeding accounts then are just like small little previews. They're just a small little foretaste of the day in which all of God's people, all believing Jews, all believing Gentiles, will gather together with Jesus at the marriage supper of the Lamb, this eternal banquet in the kingdom to come and the new creation to come. And so then, 3 astonishing miracles. Which then begs this question, okay, what's the point? Those are the miracles, what's the point? What's the overarching main point of these 3 miraculous stories? Well, I hope you've been able to see the main point and why these 3 stories are grouped together, not just in a random sort of way, but placed there intentionally, purposefully, is to teach this and to show us this. What it's meant to show us, these are meant to show us, is this, is that Jesus isn't just the Messiah, King of Israel. He's the King of all the nations of the world. He's the king of all the nations of the world. That's the whole point of these stories. That's why these stories are here. These stories are here to point us to the fact in the book of Matthew to show us that the son of David, the Messiah king of Israel, who was to come and usher in a kingdom and reign and rule over all things in his kingdom, isn't just the king of Israel. He's the king of all the nations of the world. He's the king of the Jews. He's the king of the Gentiles. He's the king who reigns and rules over everyone. Douglas O'Donnell, he wrote a commentary on the book of Matthew. I love this. He writes this. He says, in these three miracles, Jesus is showing the Great Commission before he commands it. That's exactly right. That's exactly what he's doing here. And if you've been with us throughout this series on Matthew, we've seen hints of this a few different times throughout the book of Matthew up to this point. Like going all the way back to the genealogy in Matthew chapter 1. There are four Gentiles included in Jesus' genealogy. If you go to Matthew chapter 2, we see pagan Gentile magi who are coming to bow down and worship Jesus after he's born. Go to Matthew chapter 8, we have the healing of a Roman centurion slave. And there's a few other hints and examples and indicators. And all of these things, as well as these three miracle stories that we just saw, all of them are here meant to give us a foreshadowing of the Great Commission that is to come at the very end of Matthew. And Jesus' commission to his disciples and to us to not just go to the lost sheep of Israel, but to go to all the nations of the world and make disciples of all the nations of the earth. And the obvious question then, going back to our introduction, is why? Why? Here's why, because Jesus' kingdom, his rule, his reign doesn't just encompass one little piece of land in the Middle East and one little nation called Israel. Instead, his kingdom and his rule and his reign encompasses the entire world, all of the earth, along with all the nations of the earth. And so then, if that's true, if that point is true, and if that's the point of these three miraculous stories, then what's the implication and application of that for our lives today? What difference should that make? If Jesus just isn't the king of Israel, but the king of all the nations of the world, then how should every Christian in this room respond? Well, in at least two ways. Two practical applications, and we'll end with these. First, and this is for those who are here, and you may not be a Christian. Or for those that are here, and you may think you're a Christian, but your life doesn't give evidence of it. So if that's you this morning, then you sat through this, I don't know how long we've been going, 35, 40-minute sermon up to this point. Like, what do you do with this? What's any of this have to do with you? Here's the application for your life. It's this. If this is who Jesus is, then you should bow your knee to Jesus as King. You should bow your knee and worship and give your allegiance to Jesus as King, because that's who he is. In other words, these three miracle stories we saw this morning, they're not just like fairy tales. They're not just like make-believe stories that we're just entertaining ourselves with. Instead, there really is a king who reigns and rules over this entire earth and over every nation and over every person in this world, and who is therefore deserving of the worship, the allegiance, and the obedience, and the glad submission of all peoples and all nations in this world. And that king's name is none other than Jesus. And as we've seen all the way throughout this book of Matthew, Jesus came the first time, but he's coming again. There is a day in which he's coming again. And when he comes again, the king is going to come to consummate his kingdom on this earth, finally and fully and completely. And when he does that, what that means then is that all those then who have resisted his kingship, all those who haven't bowed their knee to Jesus as king, when he returns, will be judged by him as king and therefore won't enter into his kingdom, but instead will live under his wrath and his judgment in hell forever. And so then, if that's the current state of your heart here this morning, if that's the reality of your life here this morning, then here's my appeal to you. Here's the application for you. Then turn from living for yourself. Turn from living as if you were the king of your own life, and instead turn to King Jesus and bow your knee and worship him as king. Trust in him. Believe in him. Place your faith in King Jesus as your one and only hope to save you and to rescue you from the judgment that you deserve for your rebellion against his kingship. Trust and believe that Jesus died on a cross willingly and volunteered himself to die on a cross to take the judgment that you deserve for your sin so that you can be rescued and saved and not incur the judgment that you deserve when he returns to consummate his kingdom here on earth. Bow your knee, trust, believe in King Jesus. For those of us who are here this morning and are Christians, then here's the application for our lives. For those of us who have bowed our knee to King Jesus. And the application is this, is that if Jesus isn't just the King of Israel, but if he really is the king of all the nations of the world and deserving of all the worship and the allegiance of all the nations of the world, then that means that we should be actively involved in helping to reach the nations for Jesus. And I really mean this. Like, think about this. Like, no matter who you are, again, stay-at-home mom, engineer, electrician, teacher, nurse, whoever. If you're a Christian, we should all be actively engaged, involved, even sacrificially involved toward this end. And so you're wondering, how do I do that? What does that look like in my context and where I am in my stage of life? And well, here are four ways you can be involved. One is this. You see these on your handout. Pray for the nations. First way is to pray for the nations. Like, this makes sense. Anybody and everybody can do this. But if Jesus rules and reigns over all the nations, if he is deserving the worship and the allegiance of all the nations of the world, then we all need to be praying that that would be so, that that would be a reality. And we need to be praying for missionaries that we send. We need to be praying that God would raise up more missionaries to be sent to the nations. And so this is an area I think we can grow in even more and more as a church. I think especially on Sunday mornings, like, we have certain ideas about how we can begin to pray more intentionally for nations and unreached people groups of the world on Sunday morning more than we do right now. Like, I'm so thankful for Andrew and Amber Barraclough. They have a prayer night once a month for the nations. And so if you're interested in that, send it out primarily in the email newsletter. And it gives you the date and the time and who they're going to be praying for that month. Praying for different nations, different people groups. And so encouraged by that. So be a part of that. There are also helpful apps and websites like the Joshua Project and Operation World and the Radical website, and they'll help you know just how to pray for specific nations and people groups of the world. And so let's do that. Let's imagine that. Let's all be involved in consistently and regularly praying for the nations. The second way we can be involved is giving to reach the nations. That as we have planned our budget, we're going to propose that coming up, but for next year in 2026, I think there's right around 15% of our church budget is designated for, and it's right around that number, so don't hold me precisely to that number, for global disciple-making efforts. And so it's good, but man, I wish that number was a whole lot higher. So that number was a whole lot higher. And I think that's an area that we as elders, I think that's an area that we as a church can be involved in and working together to increase that percentage of what goes toward the nations. That's where we are right now, though, and are proposing for next year. So just know 15% of every dollar you give to this church goes toward global disciple-making efforts. You can also give directly to missionaries that we've sent or missionaries that you know and personally support them that way. So just think about it. Like, I know you know, but sacrificial, like what would this look like to help maybe go through your own personal budget, minimize your own personal expenses, to free up money to be able to give to reach the nations? Third, then, way can be involved in reaching the nations is by caring for those going to the nations. Caring for those going to the nations, meaning missionaries and those that we've sent to the nations. So text them, email them, call them, send care packages to them. Go over there and visit them. What a whole host of other ways you can, just practical ways to encourage them, to remind them that they're not forgotten, to care for them well, to help them be sustained on the field. Y'all know this. I mean, it can be lonely. It's hard to leave family and friends and a church, to move halfway around the world to a cross-cultural context in which you don't even know the language, you can't even understand what they're saying, they can't understand what you're saying. You got a whole bunch of kids that you're trying to figure out, how are they going to be raised in this context? And like going to the grocery store is like a massive achievement. Like, oh, man, what'd you do today? I went to the grocery store and I survived and I brought back food and I bought stuff. And that's a massive achievement. And in the midst of that, you're asked to evangelize and disciple people who come to faith and plant a church. Like, that's a miracle. That a church could be planted in that sort of context. It's hard, so let's not just send people, but let's care for them well and help them to be sustained while they're on the field. And then fourth and finally, and this isn't for everybody, but we can go to the nations. We can go to the nations. And again, I don't hear me saying that God is commanding every single member of our church to sell their house and purchase a plane ticket and go to the nations. But I do believe he's calling some to do exactly that. I believe he's calling a whole lot of people to do that from what I've seen. That he's stirring in the hearts of a whole lot of people toward that end. Which again, is awesome. And like, what a great opportunity that we have as a church right now in this moment. And like, we don't want to waste that. We don't want to squander that. And so then, as I've mentioned, like one of the things we want to do as elders when it comes to 2026 is how can we do a better job then of leading and shepherding our church toward that end? How can we clarify? How can we communicate better what our missionary sending process is? Who will send and partner with us missionaries? Where our theology missions is? Churches that we're trying to plant over there, what do those consist of and look like and all of these things? And so, yeah, we have work to do. We have work we want to do, things we want to communicate better with you, hopefully in the days ahead, and a whole lot of room to grow when it comes to all of that stuff. But what an awesome opportunity we find ourselves in. So then why? Why should we as a church care about missions? Why should we as a church care about the nations? Why should every Christian in this room be a global Christian who's actively and sacrificially involved in helping to reach the nations, no matter who you are? Why? Well, I hope you've seen. Because Jesus isn't just the King of Israel. He's the King of all nations and all peoples and all tongues and all tribes of the world. He's the promised king from the line of David that God promised would come to rule and reign over the world and rule over all nations forever. And as king then, he's deserving of the worship and the allegiance and the glad submissions of all people, tribes, and tongues, including the Bengali in Bangladesh, the Tajiks in Afghanistan, the Wei in China, and the Fulani in Nigeria, and every other tongue and tribe and nation of the world. And because he's worthy and deserving of that as king, then as a church, let's actively and sacrificially pray and give and care for and go toward that end. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for Jesus, particularly as a room full of Gentiles who are just little dogs under the table. Thank you that you allowed crumbs to fall to us, crumbs of the gospel to fall upon us, that we would be saved, that we would be rescued, that we would be redeemed, that we would be adopted as children of the King. And as those who've been adopted as children of the King, we fall under the commission that the King has given, the commission that the King has sent us out on. The same crumbs that we devoured and that saved us, we have been commissioned with those same crumbs to go out and to make disciples of all the nations of the earth. And so, God, I pray that you would help us to better do that as a church. You'd help us to better communicate as elders, to be able to shepherd as elders, to be able to lead as elders, to better identify and assess and equip and all those things. And God, I pray for those in our church who have a desire and aspiration to be sent. God, I pray that we would work well together toward that end, because we know that King Jesus deserves and is the rightful King of all people and deserves the allegiance and the glad submission of obedience and worship of all peoples and tongues and tribes. So, Lord, help us to go, to pray, to give, to care for, and to go toward that end. And we pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.